The Guardian.
I'm Heather Stewart and this is Politics Weekly. It's back to school in Westminster this week and the bars and cafes are full of MPs comparing suntans and hatching plots. One subject generating plenty of chit-chat is a big Guardian scoop. Leaked documents showing the Home Office plans to stop free movement of EU citizens from day one of Brexit. Where does it leave a possible transition deal that's still yet to get out of the starting blocks? We'll catch up with what's happened over a summer of tetchy exchanges with Brussels. And with no government majority and a slew of tricky legislation on the horizon, we'll hear from some MPs already gaining a rebellious reputation.
I used to always wonder about whether rebelling was as scary as people made it out to be. And the truth is, yes, it is.
Not all MPs have been lounging in the sun. Others have spent the summer making badges and posters and gearing up for an autumn of campaigning. We speak to one backbencher who thinks the solution to the Brexit conundrum is simple. Stay in the single market.
I think that there's an element of just common sense about this.
Parliament is back, and so is Politics Weekly. Well, joining me for all of this, a panel you can be sure spent the summer break squinting in the sun over Brexit position papers. Our Deputy Political Editor Rowena Mason, columnist Owen Jones, and Arnab Menon, Director of UK in a Changing Europe. The Guardian this week published a leaked government document setting out its plan to manage EU migration after Brexit. I'm joined by our Home Affairs editor, Alan Travis. Alan, we've been pressing the government for months to tell us what a post-Brexit immigration landscape might look like. This is a draft Home Office paper, isn't it? But what does it tell us about what the government would like to do?
Now we know that for the first time that the Home Office wants to a phase two-step approach, a stepping stone approach. In the first phase, starting in about 18 months' time, they would expect no border checks, no extra passport checks for EU citizens. But after they've been in the country between 3 to 6 months, they will have to apply for a biometric residence permit, which means possibly giving their fingerprints and be issued with a residence permit, which will be denied to people who are job seekers, to people who can't pass minimum income threshold tests, don't have a specific job or course they're studying at in the country. And that for all but about 12% of highly skilled workers, that covers 88% of current EU migrants who come to Britain, that will only be for a temporary period of 2 years, and they will lose their right to settle in Britain. Only highly skilled workers who might be given permits for 3 to 5 years will be allowed to settle in Britain. And that breaking the link between migration and settlement has been a feature and a theme of Theresa May ever since she became Home Secretary and over the last 6 years.
You would have almost a guest worker system, in effect. You can come, you can do a job, and then you can go home, rather than settling and making your life here, as we've seen a lot of European people doing in the last...
That's right. I mean, the paradox of this particular proposal in the Home Office is it's actually very reminiscent of many European countries over the last 30, 40 years. Germany's Gastarbeiter system didn't have a route to settlement. In the last 15, 20 years, the migrant communities in Germany now do have a route to settlement in Germany. So they've abandoned that that break. But secondly, also a system of internal residence permits and enforcement controls is familiar in Spain and parts of Italy and France. But what comes with this British version is a hostile system of a hostile environment for those who fail to qualify on residence permits or find themselves on the wrong end.
Is that a government term, hostile environment? Is that the idea? You make life difficult for people.
Well, it says that so they won't be able to make it impossible for people to work and live in Britain without that permit.
That was Alan Travis, Guardian Home Affairs editor. And you can find the full 82-page leaked document online. Arnon, for anyone who's not been following every detail of these Brexit talks, what's been happening over the summer and has anything substantial changed?
Well, lots has happened in the sense that the Ministry for Leaving the EU has published a load of papers of very variable quality. We've had negotiations with Brussels in August, which must have really hacked off the French, having to come back from their holidays early. But there's been little, if any, movement. But what I would say is there is never movement in EU negotiations of any kind until the 11th hour. So actually, I think it's too soon to say they're going badly because we won't know till October at the earliest.
Yeah, and do you think we see the theatre, don't we, each month of David Davis standing there with the EU negotiator Michel Barnier and telling us not terribly much has happened. But is that not where the real nitty-gritty is going on, is it? It's the officials, isn't it, who are doing the real work?
Yeah, it's the officials. And if you use the analogy of an EU summit where they've got to sign a treaty, if you're in the room at midnight, nothing has happened and everyone assumes there will be no treaty. By 4 a.m, when everyone's panicked and everyone's focused and everyone's tired, compromises have been made. and they get a draft. I'm not saying they will get agreement in October. All I'm saying is it's far, far too soon whether they will or, to say whether they will or not.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you when that midnight is, because October for the British is a deadline, isn't it, in their minds? We would like to be able to press on to the talks about our future relationship with the EU.
I think from I think from David Davis's point of view, it looks good for him to get this through in October. Materially, actually, I don't think it makes much difference at all, because we're not going to have time to negotiate a trade deal by October of next year, whenever we sign the Article 50 agreement, or in principle. So we're going to need a transition whenever this is done.
Yeah. And is there enough time to get that transition deal done properly? I mean, there's talk, isn't there, in government of what they call an off-the-shelf deal, which would be something similar to the relationship that we already have, presumably?
Well, I think the less time we leave ourselves, the more off-the-shelf it has to be.
And Rowena, we had reports over the weekend that Michel Barnier has said the British people need to be told the realities of Brexit. Do you think there's any sense that two sides are inching closer together?
It doesn't really seem like it at this point, although Barnier did row back a little bit from that and said he'd been taken out of context. And he just wanted to teach everybody in the whole of Europe about how great the single market was. It feels like there's still a lot of tension and hostility on both sides, but we can probably expect that to get worse as the talks go on and things get more fraught and it gets more last minute, as Anand was saying. So I think we haven't seen the worst of the rhetoric flying between Brussels and London yet.
And it's more complex than that too, isn't it? Because the different cabinet ministers have slightly different positions on what kind of deal they would like to see, both during the transition and afterwards.
Yes, that's very true. We were talking just now about whether we'd have an off-the-shelf transitional deal, something that Philip Hammond, the Chancellor, very much wants. He thinks there's no point negotiating something bespoke. But it seems to be a priority of Theresa May and David Davis to have something that's specifically tailored to Britain, I mean, almost as a way of saving face, perhaps, because that's what they've said from the start. But that's just one example of the myriad things that... where there's a differing position between cabinet ministers. I think the other example of that, which I'm sure we're about to go on to talk about in a minute, is the leaked immigration paper. There's definitely distance between different cabinet ministers about how harsh the restriction should be on EU migrants after we leave the EU.
And Owen, meanwhile, the Labour Party's been conducting its own tense negotiations about its Brexit strategy, and they've moved quite a long way over the summer. Is that fair?
Well, it's been an evolution. I mean, I would say, you know, the Tories have a habit of setting a house on fire and then, saying they're the only ones who can extinguish the fire. And that is Labour's dilemma. We had a referendum called for partisan reasons. We had a snap election called for partisan reasons that delayed negotiating time and weakened Britain's hand in Europe, where we're widely regarded amongst many governments as a laughingstock. What they're arguing, Labour, is that 18 months is an unrealistic amount of time to get a bespoke deal in place, that a cliff edge beckons, that there's economic uncertainty, which is obviously bad for business, and therefore, as a bare minimum for a transitional period, Britain should stay in the customs union and the single market. And their argument is, when we talk about, you know, they talk about the benefits of retaining the benefits of the single market and the customs union, they make the point that's their end goal, and how they get there is secondary to that. Which means Britain could stay in the customs union after a transitional agreement, perhaps even in the single market. And that's where there's been, I think, an evolution of views. Because there is a diversity of views, of course, in the shadow cabinet. But, I mean, it is a spectacular mess which Labour expected to have to deal with. So I always think, you know, shifting the onus onto the Labour Party to deal with this is I always find, you know, lacks generosity. But the problem, I think, with the whole, you know, what Labour will be confronted with, they'll have to keep using a phrase, clearing up the Tories' mess, to borrow from what the Tories spent many years saying.
They're still saying it, yeah.
They're still saying it 7 years later. I met EU diplomats before the referendum, and the point they said to me was there was already resentment amongst their voters of what they regarded as special treatment for Britain on everything from the rebate to the Schengen agreement to the euro, that any economic consequences of Brexit would make those voters even angrier, that they have anti-EU and anti-immigrant parties of their own to deal with who they don't want emboldened, and obviously the precedent of a major EU state leaving is not good for them. And we're dealing with 27 EU governments here, and what the diplomat said to me with a rather wry smile was, of course we could come up with a deal and then put it to a referendum of our own people. So I just think there's a problem, obviously, in terms of Labour has to position itself according to the circumstances of the time. And if we have a situation where negotiations are very chaotic, where EU governments are leaking or suggesting that it's so chaotic they think it's an intentional British strategy, then, you know, I think Labour's position has to adapt to the circumstances which have evolved, because we're not getting anywhere. I know this idea it'll be the 11th hour, but these are so complex negotiations with so many governments. The idea we can just think, oh, it'll be something will come up at the end, I'm not so sure myself, but...
Is that fair? Is that the right approach from Labour to some extent sit back a little bit, not give us too much detail about what they'd expect to see in the long term, or do they need to set out their stall more clearly on this?
Well, I think that depends on your view of how important Brexit is. I mean, in a sense, for me, the big division in the Labour Party is between those who think a hard Brexit is a price worth paying for a Corbyn government, and those who don't. That is to say, for some people, this is just a matter of political opposition. And let's face it, they're doing what John Smith did. It's exactly the same thing, which is to say, we don't need to spell out a detailed position on the EU because we're the opposition. But what we will do is we will attack the government. And let's face it, the government is giving them plenty of ammunition at the moment to do that. But there are those on the backbench of the Labour Party who actually think that this is such a unique issue. This will determine the fate of the country in such a profound way that you can't afford to treat it as just another public policy issue where the opposition opposes. We need to set out our stall. And there are, of course, those who think that actually Labour should be trying to lead public opinion to shift it back the other way. There is no sign of public opinion moving yet in that direction, I would say. So
towards staying in.
Yeah. I mean, there's no sign of that buyer's remorse that everyone claims to have heard a lot of, but in the polls, it's just not there.
There's a YouGov poll the other day which said, how would you vote in a referendum? And it was Remain 48%, Leave 52%.
Oh, that sounds a bit familiar.
Yeah.
Well, the YouGov tracker has been absolutely on those sort of numbers since June of last year.
Yeah. Yeah. And Rowena, we've got this government without a majority that has to do a lot of legislative work. There's going to be a lot of action in Parliament, isn't there, to try and lay the groundwork for Brexit. What's coming first?
The crucial piece of legislation that's going to be debated today by MPs is called the EU Withdrawal Bill, formerly known as the Great Repeal Bill or the Repeal Bill. And the point of that is to take all the existing body of EU law that applies to the UK and convert it into UK law. Which sounds uncontroversial, but the reason that Labour is opposing it so strongly is because contained within it are powers for ministers to make changes to legislation without the kind of usual scrutiny of Parliament. And the government's argument is that there's so much that they've got to change in legislation. So there's about 1,000 pieces of legislation that they want to pass through secondary legislation or delegated legislation so quickly, basically. And they're saying that they just don't have time for it to go through the whole parliamentary scrutiny that you would usually have. But on such an enormous constitutional issue, this has caused a lot of consternation among MPs. And so while its second reading stage, I think the legislation is likely to pass. Conservatives backbenchers won't kick up much of a fuss about it. At later stages in the legislation, I think it's going to be October after party conferences, there is an opportunity for Conservative backbenchers to rebel on this issue of ministers getting too much power over the conversion of EU laws to UK laws and other issues, potentially such as staying in the single market, staying in bodies such as Euratom, all manner of things could cause trouble for Theresa May. And it looks really, really likely that she's going to have to make some concessions, row back, listen to the Conservative backbench rebels and make some changes in order to avoid a government defeat. And throughout all of this, Labour's ultimate goal will really be to try and bring down the government by causing a huge defeat in Parliament.
It's a really difficult balancing act, the withdrawal, because on the one hand, we have to have something like this to leave. And so Labour need to be careful not to be portrayed as the party that's trying to stop Brexit, because obviously that will cause them electoral problems. But on the other hand, this is not simply a cut and paste issue. It's not simply the government taking EU law and copying it into UK law, because some of it has to be amended. So if you take a hypothetical example, environmental legislation from the EU quite often mentions EU institutions like the Commission or other regulatory agencies. The government's going to have to change that wording because we'll no longer be under the authority of the European Commission. And if, for instance, a minister decides, here's a bit of EU legislation on air quality that says that ultimately we're responsible to the European Commission, let's change that to saying ultimately it'll be Michael Gove who decides as minister, that's a substantive change to our legal system that is really, really important. And the question is, shouldn't Parliament have a say ultimately over that? The problem is there are too many bits of legislation for them to do every one.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Labour's argument is, you know, if the referendum was take back control, that doesn't mean concentrate more power in the executive. And we're talking about 9,000 statutory instruments. Some of it will be, I'm sure, completely innocuous, but others, of course, won't be. And Parliament won't have an actual say over that, which, again, if Parliament, our Parliament's supposed to become sovereign now, because, you know, great democratic revolution leaving the EU. Some of us were cynical about that, obviously, but that's why Labour have to take this position. It would be utterly bizarre in a democracy like ours if the opposition, the official opposition, didn't hold the government to account as it tried to, you know, basically, without consulting Parliament, make such sweeping possible changes.
And you think they can square the circle on that? Because we had resignations, didn't we, from the Labour front bench earlier in the year when the party, when Jeremy Corbyn whipped the party to back Article 50 to trigger Brexit. Won't there be voters who'll think, hang on, I thought you backed this Brexit thing and now you seem to be trying to stop it?
Well, I mean, Labour's always had to have a difficult balancing act, obviously, because uniquely amongst political parties, because, you know, Tory Remainers, not always, but often, are a bit shrug their shoulders, oh well. And the difference with Labour Remainers, some Labour Remainers, I don't want to generalise, because you'll find a lot of them on Twitter, but in the real world it's a different thing, but you'll get people in London in particular who are very, very angry about Brexit. They think it's the worst thing in the world, and they'll spend a lot of time on Twitter saying it's only an advisory referendum, which can somehow be ignored, indeed. And then you get others, particularly in the north, older working class people, often in small towns, who think Brexit is a fantastic, great thing, and they've got their country back. And they've always had to have a difficult balancing act. I mean, I would say, since the referendum, there's been this argument that, you know, Labour's Brexit position will be their big Achilles heel and the whole electoral coalition will collapse. Jeremy Corbyn accused of being not enthusiastic during the referendum, then voting to trigger Article 50, then after the referendum, you know, the various positions on the EU, and that hasn't actually happened. You know, every single time commentators have said that, that has just isn't the case. But that doesn't mean they should be complacent, because it is a more unwieldy electoral coalition than most, which is why they have to keep emphasising, on the one hand, look, we do have a very different Brexit approach from the Conservatives, from giving EU citizens their rights in day one to this transitional agreement and the single market and customs union staying there for at least 2 years, which is obviously different from the Conservatives. But on the other hand, saying, look, we are leaving the European Union. That's what the voters voted for, and we have to abide by that. And what the polling suggests is millions of people who voted Remain take that position, that they don't like what's happening. If a referendum happened today, they would still vote to remain in the European Union. But given how people voted last year, however narrowly, we lost that, and therefore the referendum has to be honoured. And that is Labour's position, but it's accused of being kind of, you know, too confused. But it does have to take into account a complex electoral coalition. It doesn't have a choice.
Even if Labour's official position is coming into clearer focus, it's one that doesn't go far enough to satisfy those who want an unequivocal commitment to the single market and freedom of movement. Leading the charge from the Labour backbenches is Alison McGovern, and I spoke to her earlier.
I think that Labour's leadership now needs to be about saying there is a way of getting a deal that is being in the single market, so making sure that we keep those European protections that we already have, our rights at work, stopping austerity and making sure that our country has a proper future. And I think Leave voters and Remain voters can support that. It will make Brexit happen more smoothly. And you know, if at the end of the day we need to get a good deal, I think who do you want to be making that deal? Is it the Tory party with the shambles that we've seen? Or is it people who are frankly used to being negotiators with a powerful person sitting on the other side of the table? And that's the trade union movement, isn't it? Who knows how to make a deal for working people? It's the trade union movement and their political wing, which is the Labour Party.
And the trade union movement has been quite important, hasn't it, in shifting the Labour frontbench's position into accepting the idea of continued single market and customs union membership, at least for the duration of some sort of transition period. Do you welcome that shift that's happened over the summer?
Of course. I think that there's an element of just common sense about this, which if you represent people who work, you know, my constituents who work in Vauxhall Motors and Ellesmere Port, and you're staring in the face the possibility of crashing out of the single market, literally, you know, car parts that before they reach their final destination might cross that European border 5 or 6 times before they end up in a car that's sold to Germany as 80% of the cars that are made at Ellesmere Port are. There's just a reality here that we're part of that market. The question is, how do we stay part of it?
Isn't the problem, though, that it would require continued freedom of movement, free movement of people throughout the EU, which is a kind of founding, you know, one of the pillars of the single market? I mean, we've seen a leak of the Home Office, what the Home Office would like to do on EU migration, which is quite a harsh crackdown. But didn't voters in leave areas clearly signal that they wanted migration to be reduced?
I guess the question is, what is it about migration that people are worried about? Because if people are worried about trafficking and security, I think they're right to be. The answer to that is investment in our police and in our security services, and investment in our border force and the facilities that we have at our borders in order to keep people safe. If people are worried about low pay, then the best way to protect the pay of people who earn least in our country is the law that we already have in this country. We have a National Minimum Wage Act. The government can support protecting low-paid workers at any time it chooses. It has that power already. And in any case, we know that the problem in our labour market is to do with lack of trade union representation and the way that collective bargaining has been successively killed off. Those are the things we need to act on if people are worried about low pay. So I think where people have got concerns about immigration, I think we can definitely address them. But what we ought not to fall into is kind of kowtowing to the kind of arguments that Nigel Farage has made. I mean, nobody in the Labour Party wants to do that. Shortly after the referendum, I was having my nails done in a nail bar. And I remember having this conversation with the person who was doing my nails, who was talking really enthusiastically about just being back from Ibiza, where she had spent, you know, 6 months working in a resort, doing her job as a beautician. And she'd had a great time. And I couldn't bear to say to her, you do realise the country has just voted to stop you doing that ever again. So we do have to talk about the benefits of free movement, and that cuts both ways. You know, in the end, the single market is a deal, right? You know, we might not like every aspect of it or think it's perfect, but it's about negotiating for the British people and getting the best chance and opportunity for them. And I think that's what the single market offers. And, you know, I'm prepared to fight for that.
Alison McGovern there. Rowena, before the summer, it felt as though Theresa May's position was quite vulnerable and fragile, and we were all wondering with some horror when the next general election might come. Well, you know, could it be within months? Could it be within a year? But last week in Japan, she was telling reporters, wasn't she, that she's ready to go on, there's things that need doing, and she's going to fight the next general election. What do her fellow Tories think about that?
Well, I think the prospect of an immediate leadership challenge to Theresa May has receded somewhat over the summer. There was an initial bit of plotting and letters going into the 1922 committee among some very disgruntled former ministers, and also speculation around David Davis, the Brexit secretary, people saying, well, this is his moment, it's now or never, really. If she lasts another few years, actually, the baton's going to pass to another generation. But really, if you look at those newer generation of MPs, they were very, very reluctant to wield the knife against Theresa May now. Partly because they do want a new generation of MPs to have a chance at getting to the top, and partly because a lot of them are in unexpectedly marginal seats after the election. People like Amber Rudd, Justine Greening, Boris Johnson, Ian Duncan Smith now have very small majorities when they've been used to being far more secure. So really the mood in the Conservative Party, I would say, has sort of calmed down a bit. But then it sort of got inflamed again when Theresa May said this slightly ill-advised comment on the plane when she was in Japan, saying that she wanted to go on and on. She sort of sounded like Margaret Thatcher in the dying days of her premiership. And that's kind of ruffled a few feathers, and MPs are just thinking, how out of touch can the Prime Minister be that she thinks that she will actually be leading the country into another general election in 5 years' time? So she's possibly destabilised herself a little bit again, but probably the bulk of MPs think, well, she was caught a little bit on the hop. And I mean, it's a very difficult question to answer in a way. She can't, you know, if she says, no, I won't be fighting the next general election, then she's automatically triggered effectively a leadership contest earlier than she wants.
And Anna, there's some logic, isn't there, to the idea that you hear around Westminster a bit that Brexit is going to require a lot of kind of painful compromises, and that poor old Theresa May is kept in place to sort of take the incoming fire from Brussels, as it were, and then steps aside and lets somebody else take over fresh.
No, absolutely. And I think firstly, no Prime Minister should ever say how long they're going to be Prime Minister for. That's got to be the lesson of our recent politics, because whether you say I'm going soon or I'm never going, it causes trouble. I think the generational point is really important, that within the Parliamentary Conservative Party, the newer generations, the 2010, the 2015 intake, are A, irritated with the people in charge now, who they see as having lost them the election, and B, don't want a leadership contest that is that centres around the EU. So they want us to be out before it happens, which gives time for one of their number to get the top job. So I think her position in that sense is quite secure. What is really interesting, I think, is if you look at the political implications of that leaked immigration document that The Guardian came up with the other day, because for me, that strongly suggested that the Conservatives are thinking about leaving the EU, hammering immigration, and then before any economic fallout of that can be felt, thinking about going to the people. So my first thought when I read that paper was they're thinking about an election in 2019 as soon as we've left the European Union, and they can say we've stopped immigration and we've left the European Union, vote for us.
Well, you're a very cynical man. That would be a very cynical approach. And there are senior Tories signalling their concerns, aren't there, about some of these things. So Ruth Davidson, I noticed yesterday, giving an interview where somebody had asked her what a big concern was about Brexit. And her answer was something like, you know, we have an economic downturn we can't recover from, or a short-term hit and we don't bounce back, or words to that effect. I mean, there are senior Tories really quite worried about the economic potential economic damage, aren't there?
No, absolutely. And there are a variety of cynical interpretations you can have, one of which is, if you remember last year, the Tory conference was all about registering foreign workers and the like, and within about 48 hours they said we were only joking. So it might be that. It might be that this is the build-up conference season, that they'll come out with all this sort of anti-immigrant rhetoric before the conference and afterwards say, actually, we need to be more sensible about the economy. So it could just be a very, very short-term tactic.
Yeah. And Owen, Jeremy Corbyn's out and about around the country the whole summer pretty much, wasn't he? He didn't seem to have much of a break, although he enjoys it so much. It's like a kind of holiday for him, isn't it? But, you know, he's been hammering a lot of these questions, hasn't he, that came up a lot in the election campaign. Not Brexit so much. He doesn't talk about that very much on the stump. He talks about low pay. He talks about exploitation of workers. He talks about, you know, food banks and all these kinds of things. Is Theresa May going to have to come up with solutions to some of these things, do you think, if... She, and not get swamped by Brexit if she's going to survive, and they're going to have, the Tories are going to have some sort of answer to Labour at the next general election whenever it comes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, when the general election was called, it was supposed to be the Brexit referendum, wasn't it? And that worried Labour to begin with, very much so, on the first couple of days. They thought that's exactly the framing that will damage us the most. We have to shift the conversation onto other things, which they then did, and forced the Conservatives into a defensive position where they've stayed ever since. So it's absolutely critical, Labour are concerned, that they stay exactly there.
And they're still doing it, aren't they? Jeremy Corbyn did it again at Prime Minister's Questions yesterday. He didn't talk about Brexit, he talked about all these other issues.
No, because obviously there are divisions within Labour's electoral coalition, and the more you talk about it, the more you accentuate those divisions. You drive up the agenda. If people had gone into the ballot boxes thinking about Brexit above everything else in the election, the result would have been probably quite different. So yes, that's Labour's position, to have a permanent general election campaign. The Conservatives themselves, the problem they have, I mean, they're using Theresa May as a human shield. They think, you know, let her absorb the anger, throw her out the way at some point. They don't have an obvious successor. The mood of total delusion amongst the Tory grassroots is exemplified by the fact Jacob Rees-Mogg is now their favourite to be leader, a man who opposes abortion in all circumstances and the civil rights of LGBTQ people, which, you know, is not just, I suppose, politically bad from my own position, but also given the huge deficit the Tories have is amongst younger voters whose views have shifted dramatically away from those sorts of socially conservative views. I mean, that's just, you know, poison. And the problem is they're flapping around with no real answers. Tim Montgomery, who I quite like, as a commentator, but, you know, he's a conservative commentator, and one of the ideas he was floating to engage with youth was to build a museum about the remembering the dead who were died under communism. I just don't quite see that's gonna win people over. So they don't have an answer to basically an economic model which has been in place now since the late 1970s, which has produced growing levels of insecurity, particularly for younger, by which now I mean people under 50, frankly, on everything from jobs, housing, living standards, and the, you know, what the potential of their children. And the Tories don't have any clear answers to that. And the reason they're a bit stuck at the moment is they either double down on that economic model and, you know, they take the argument, we just aren't being more, we need to be more evangelical about it. We just haven't.
That's the Philip Hammond answer, isn't it? We didn't talk enough about our economic success at the election campaign.
Exactly. Free markets are great. The market's great. Let's roll back the state's a good thing. Or they start saying, well, actually, there are very big problems with this economic model, which Theresa May actually hinted at from day one without the substance. But then you start legitimising the arguments of your opposition. You start conceding ground. And then you start, people come to the conclusion, why not just vote for the real thing? So you can see that, for example, on the public sector pay cap, the division there is, well, actually, no, we need to double down on this because otherwise we concede the argument on austerity. But then, well, actually, we're going to keep losing elections if we stick to that. And that's why they're flapping around. They don't have a clear route to stay in power. That's their fear anyway.
But Owen, can I just ask you one question about Jeremy Corbyn, which is there a realisation either on his part or among his circle that if we ended up leaving the EU, leaving the customs union, leaving the single market, that would make any sort of social justice agenda far, far harder to achieve because our economy would be shrinking at quite a rate?
Well, I think the dilemma that they have is either you stay in the customs union, the single market, which Labour committed to in a transitional period to avoid a cliff edge. But then there's a question of democratic deficit, which is, are you then subject to EU laws? I know this is a contested point, but are you then subject to EU laws to which you can't contribute to? And, you know, indeed, Vernon Bognner, the academic, in his argument for a second referendum, said we'd become an EU client state, which would, you know, the democratic deficit or perceived democratic deficit, you know, fueled the move to Brexit in the first place. This would make it even worse. Or you leave both, and then there's potentially a big economic price to which Labour's own voters pay the highest price. But that is a very, very big dilemma. So their argument is, can we get the benefits of the single market and the customs union? Does that mean staying particularly in the customs union? I think that is more open for grabs, particularly at the moment in Labour. The single market, there's a bigger question mark. But you're right, if Labour are saying they're going to try and keep the benefits of the single market without being a member of it, then they need to spell out exactly how that is possible to avoid the sort of economic shock you're talking about.
I think it's also worth being explicit about the fact that a transition doesn't prevent a cliff edge, it delays it.
You know, I would still love if, you know, if everyone just took off a partisan hat and just said, this is what Labour should do, and had a clear answer, I would love to hear it, because their view, obviously, is they can't do anything unless they're in power. And this is the bizarre thing, because the traditional argument against Jeremy Corbyn, the left in general, is that they weren't pragmatic enough to get into power. They weren't prepared to make compromises, and now they're doing exactly that, and they have, you know, they genuinely are trying to.
Well, and it was their argument against the sort of the Tony Blair type approach, wasn't it? Their argument was that Tony Blair wasn't purist enough, and there were too many compromises.
But their view was that's because he surrendered the argument to the economic model of Margaret Thatcher, which Labour is definitely committed to overturning. No one can say that Labour's programme overall is a compromise. It isn't. It's a very clear departure from the status quo. But on certain issues like this, they are saying, well, actually, we do have to be flexible. We can't be too dogmatic. And the irony is, it's some of the so-called centrists who are being the most dogmatic about this, and not prepared to look at the political realities on the ground at all, whilst Labour's saying, look, we have political realities we have to deal with, which we have to juggle with economic realities, and it's very difficult to find a clear path through it.
There we go. Jeremy Corbyn, arch pragmatist. Right. with so much at stake, it's little wonder that MPs are not dividing neatly down party lines. In fact, this could end up being a very rebellious parliament. Our political reporter Jessica Elcott's been stalking the corridors of Westminster and sniffing dissent in the air.
So it's a new term here in Parliament, and the balance of power suddenly feels very different. Suddenly, the people who hold the cards aren't in the cabinet room. They're on the floor of the House of Commons. And rebellions, which might have been symbolic, now have a whole new power. Some MPs never rebel, and others only once in a lifetime, and some make a rather regular habit of it. You could probably count Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn and Brexit Secretary David Davis among the latter when they were backbenchers. And they'll be the ones urging their MPs not to rebel in the coming weeks. I've been speaking to some MPs who have rebelled in the past and to party whips who try and keep them in line about how it really feels to walk down the opposite lobby to your colleagues and whether those tales of whips dark arts that you might have seen in House of Cards or the play This House are really true?
Bob Neil, I'm the Conservative MP for Bromley and Chislehurst. It's actually quite a tough thing to do because by the nature of it, we are really all community animals. A party is a community. We all like to be team players. You've got friends, who many of whom go back a long way. So it's not something you do lightly.
When you rebelled over Article 50, was there anything that could have made you reconsider?
I wasn't alone in this. As you know, a number of others of us came to the same conclusion. Had a number of meetings with ministers. We had meetings with the whips. We told them where we were coming from. Nobody tried to strong-arm me. Can't speak for anyone else because I wasn't in the conversations with anyone else. Perhaps I'm long enough in the tooth that they don't know that there's not much, you know, not much on me. I've been a minister, I got the T-shirt, that sort of thing wasn't going to wash anymore. So to be fair to them, nobody tried.
So what happens afterwards? What are the consequences for rebelling?
I think some disappointed looks and a conversation, put it that way, which was entirely civilised.
Tulip Sadiq, Labour MP for Hampstead and Kilburn.
So you, back on the back benches now, after a short stint on the front bench last year, you did rebel against the party on Article 50, and that was something that, you know, quite a few of your colleagues did. How does it feel to do that, to go against what your party wanted you to do?
You know, when I was outside Parliament, as in I was not an MP, I used to always wonder about whether rebelling was as scary as people made it out to be. And the truth is, yes, it is. So first off, you are told over and over again by the whips that you're voting a certain way. You're texted that, you're called, your whip calls you constantly to remind you which lobby you should be going into, what the party line is. You have the weekly Parliamentary Labour Party meeting where it's reinforced what the whip is. And if they get any kind of whiff of the fact that you're planning to rebel, they start calling you right from the top. So there'll be shadow ministers calling you, there'll be the chief whip calling you, and sometimes the deputy leader will call you, the leader will call you and try and persuade you otherwise. For me, it was a no-go option. Like, I knew I did not want to vote for Article 50. They're serial rebellers and they're people who've never rebelled in like 50 years of being an MP. I guess I fall in the middle because I don't plan to rebel on everything. If things are very important to me, I will in the future rebel.
It's Mark Harper, Member of Parliament for the Forrester Dean and former government chief whip. So interestingly, when I was chief whip, I thought I had a small majority because we had a working majority of 16, which of course by today's standards seems enormous since we don't have one at all by ourselves, and only a relatively small one even with the support of the DUP. I mean, my approach was always with a small majority, and I think this is still even more true without one. You need to, in today's world, you need to persuade people to support you. I don't think the 1970s approach that we may all have seen in James Graham's excellent play, This House, I don't think that's as effective as it once was. I think you've got to persuade people, and I also think in the modern world, many of the things that appear to have taken place in the 1970s, if you've tried them now, I think you'd find them, you'd be reading about them on social media within 5 minutes of them taking place, which means I don't think they would be very effective.
So what does work then?
The starting position for me is, I think it's always a very good, depends what the government's trying to do, but assuming the government is trying to deliver its manifesto and it's trying to deliver the things that we were elected on, there's a bit of sort of basics around reminding people that, you know, we all like to think as MPs that we get elected because people vote for us. But the reality is some people vote for us as individuals, but most of the people that voted for me because, you know, they wanted a Conservative government, and they voted for me because I'm a Conservative and they wanted us to deliver our programme. So it's a bit of reminding people that you get elected, whether you're a Conservative or, you know, obviously from the Labour Party's point of view on their programme, because you said you would deliver some things. And it's kind of reminding people that that's what they're here for, to deliver the things they promised to do at the election. So there's a bit of that, and there's also a bit of accepting in politics. Politics is a team game. It's not an individual sport. If you're going to achieve anything, you've got to do it by persuading people and taking people with you. So does that mean you'll be enthusiastic, equally enthusiastic about every single thing the government's doing? No. But if you expect colleagues to support you when you want to do the things that you passionately care about, you do sometimes have to support things that you might not be super enthusiastic about, because it's a team. You have to make compromises in politics to get things done.
Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Alan Travis, Alison McGovern, Rowena Mason, Anand Menon, Owen Jones and Jessica Elgott. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.